My name is John Nidzinger. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and loving God and the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I find not found it necessary to take a drink since April 25th of 97. For that, I'm truly grateful. I like that phrase, too. I've not found it necessary to take a drink, because it was necessary when I was drinking. It wasn't just for fun. It was fun in the beginning, but it really became necessary for me. I want to thank everybody for inviting me down. It's a real pleasure to visit other groups. And if you told me 3 years ago I'd be doing something like this, I'd say you're nuts. This is not something I would have planned. Of course, my plans made me an alcoholic. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I was born in El Paso, and we moved immediately to Fort Worth, and I've been there ever since. Fort Worth. My father's in construction. He was my first introduction to heavy metal. Yeah, he was an alcoholic from my earliest recollections. My father, I smelled beer all my life. You know, that's what I remember mostly about when I think of my father. I remember smelling beer. And he was really a rough man. Everybody was afraid of my father. They called him Mr. Raymond. Everybody did. He was they were from the country. Him and my mother were raised in Bluffdale, Texas, and it's really out in the woods. Really, I'm not even sure if my family tree forks. I don't really know. They were. They were raised together as children, you know, and back out in the woods, you just kind of hooked up with whoever was in the woods with you, I guess. But it's a strange deal. One of these days, I'm going to find out what that was all about. I'm not sure I want to know too much. But I do remember only seeing my father cry twice. And that's also one of my first recollections of being selfish and self-centered. I think I maybe was 5 years old, and one of my wonderful step-uncles, he killed my grandmother. He blew her away with a shotgun. And I was five, and I remember my grandmother was making me a tricycle. She was restoring his tricycle. And I remember crying my eyes out because I wasn't going to get that tricycle. I didn't cry because she was gone. I didn't cry because my father had lost a mother or any of that stuff. I just knew I wasn't going to get that tricycle. And I think I've pretty well been self-centered ever since. But it was a strange family. I'm really not too... there's only three of us left in the world right now, Nidzingers. And it's still strange today. I don't really have a very close relationship with anybody. I have a brother and my mother, and it's just kind of strange. I try to do the best I can to have a relationship with my mom. She's old and she lives by herself and she's real independent, but it's bizarre. But I'm a musician. I have been since I was 8 years old. I think I wanted to be different. I wanted to be different than my family was. They were real country redneck bigot type of thing. And I don't know, for some reason, I just didn't like that. I didn't want to be like that. And I remember watching Lawrence Welk on television. We'd watch Lawrence Welk, and I wanted an accordion because that looked like a cool thing to do. And they couldn't afford an accordion, so they got me a guitar. Wonder what would happen if they got me an accordion. I might have been playing electric bar mitzvahs or something. But I had a talent for it. I don't know where it came from. There's nobody in my family that was musically oriented. It just came natural to me for some reason. I started playing when I was eight, and by the time I was nine, I had a gig. I was in the beer joints. I was the little bitty kid playing with the 75-year-old fiddle player and the 80-year-old drummer, and we're playing country western music. And for some reason I could play. I don't know where that came from. But that's also my first introduction to alcohol, besides smelling it on my desk. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be special. And I hid behind that guitar for a long, long time. They would let me sip on their beers, you know, in the clubs. We'd go up and down the Jacksboro Highway and the Mansfield Highway there in Fort Worth and these little bitty beer joints, and I'd take my little guitar and I'd sip on people's beers. They thought it was kind of cute, you know. And I don't really remember getting a buzz, because I think I'm pretty buzzed just being 9 years old, you know, and having a guitar on and being in a nightclub, you know, with all the lights and everybody laughing and everybody seemingly having a good time. I did that for all through my, I still do that, as a matter of fact. I still play in the clubs. But going through that thing, it was real strange because I was little and everybody else was big. I always thought I was special and I wanted to be like they were. I wanted to have those cars and we'd watch that country stuff and television, and we'd see the Porter Wagners, and man, I like those clothes. That guy had a suit knock your eyes out, you know. So I wanted to be in that world, and I did. I got in that world and I stayed in that world. I can honestly say I did not have a real life until I got sober. I just lived in that facade. I was a star. I was a rock star, too. I became a rock star. I wanted to do that. I liked rock and roll. I liked it loud, and I still do. I went on up to about 13 years old, and this guy came up to me. We were playing the sock hops and the holiday hops and the little dances and things they do at the roller rinks and stuff like that. I got my first record deal. This guy came up to me and said, you got potential, boy. And let's make a record, you know. And I said, I'm 13 years old. I said, this is great. Let's do that. And this guy was a grocery sacker at Buddy's. We're talking big time. This guy was big time. But we cut these little 45 records, and had 45s back then on real wax and everything. I think we had like 150 of them. And they were hand-drawn labels. That's how classy we were. He, with a martial art or something, he hand-drew this little thing. And Torch Records, I'll never forget that. But you could tell it was just drawn by hand. But we sold out immediately at the little sock hops. I'm rocking here. And I'm still doing those little beer joint gigs, and then I go play for the kids, for my peers, people my age and stuff. And, of course, we're getting into the girls here. Play guitar. You want to get the women? Play guitar. And that's another thing that I really exploited. I wanted to be a star. I don't know how else to put it. I just wanted to be a star. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be rich. And I wanted to be loved. And I sure went about it backwards, getting all three of those things. We put out about four records on Torch labels. And the guy quit his sacking job and became a manager. And so we started playing some better nightclubs. I got in with the grown-ups then. Started playing with in real suit and tie nightclubs and stuff. And man, these people had the real cars. They had the Cadillacs and they had the suit and ties, and they were really having fun. They had their hair styled, you know, and they had the pompadours and stuff. So it was, and they got money, boy. They're spending that money, and they're drinking them drinks that are pink and green and got all these things sticking out of them. Man, I like that. Let's try that. But also, and there's also some drugs in my story, and I hope that doesn't offend anyone. And it's just part of my story. And alcohol was always there, no matter what I did. I started with it and I ended up with it. It's the last thing I put down, the first thing I picked up. But I rocked on through high school and junior high, and I never really went to class because I was also in the band that I played a horn, a baritone, this great big ugly thing. And I would always get out of class and go down to the band room. I'd get a pass. My band director would sign me a pass to get out of class. And I'd go down there and hang out in the band room all day and play horn. And I'd even bring my guitar down there and play guitar. They had a stage band thing we played in. And I was so damn special. I just didn't understand what everybody else was doing. I had no idea. I didn't learn anything in school, really. I don't understand today how I got graduated. I don't know how I did that because I really didn't do any work. I really didn't. The teachers were really loose in in Fort Worth in those days. I don't know. They were really loose because they knew I'd been out playing because I'd play till 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd come in to sleep in my classes when I wasn't down the band room, and they'd let me. They let me. I don't know. I guess they figured he's out working or something. He needs his rest. I don't know. But I was also so special. I'd pull my desk up beside the teacher's desk and face the class. I mean, like, I don't know what that's about. But I just didn't want to sit out there with them, you know, because I'm different. And I don't know how they let me get away with that either, because nobody else did it. You know, I'd get up and go sit over on the heater, or I wouldn't stay in my desk. I'd actually pull my desk up and face the class with my teacher, me and her. And I don't know what that's about. I just didn't belong or something. And another thing, I always felt too that I was better than everybody, or I was not as good as everybody. I came from that background that I didn't want to acknowledge. I didn't want to be like them. I felt less than. And I really overcompensated, man. I blasted it out over the top, being a star. I used to call my mother and tell her that my teacher asked her to bring my guitar to my class. And then I would tell my teacher that my mother said she needed to bring me my guitar. So I was playing both sides against the middle. And that way all the kids would pay attention to me. You know, he's got a guitar. And I'd get there and I'd play for the kids at the end of class. So she had let me do that. And again, I was trying to be special. I rocked into a place called the Holiday Hop in Fort Worth. It was a roller rink. And they had these Tina Go-Go things. And then I met my first future ex-wife. I saw her. And I'm swinging 16 years old. And man, there's this tall, good-looking girl in go-go boots. She's a go-go girl, and she's just gorgeous. Man, this girl was just knocked out, and I had to have her. I was going to do everything I could do, and I did. I proceeded to pursue her, and I caught her, and I'll skip around a lot because it's a big blur. 37 years of yaga-hoogie. Just before that, though, another thing back to my dad. My dad and my mom and my dad really resented the fact that they got me that guitar, but they resented the fact, for some reason, that I loved it and I was good at it. They didn't like that. I don't know what that was about either, but it became my world. I remember one time I was playing that Holiday Hop thing I was just talking about, and my dad was drinking heavily. He worked construction, like I said, and he would go out and he'd work all day long and bust ass, and he'd bring that check home. But when he got home, it was beer. It was Miller time, man. He was drunk every night, and on the weekends, it was just a constant drunk for him. And like I said, we were all afraid of him. And he would just do things for no reason. When, you know, I'm in a band and I'm the lead singer, I'm the lead guitar player, and they can't do it without me. But he would say, you know, you're not going tonight for some reason. And we'd have a job and it pays money and everything. And we got our little suits and our little ties and matching things. And just for no reason, he'd say you're not going just because he's in his mood or whatever you want to call it. He was real physical. He slapped me around a lot. I remember one time this gentleman gave us a giant piece of leather that for me to make a guitar strap with, and my dad took it away from me, and he made him a belt out of it. And I remember every time he'd beat me with that belt, I said, man, that's my guitar strap I'm getting beat with. And something about that I didn't like either. But one night, he said, you're not going. And so he locked me in my room there. Well, I cracked the window open and crawled out the window with my guitar. It was the Battle of the Bands. I had to be there. And so I snuck out the window. My boys picked me up, and we went down there. And I remember we just finished playing. We just finished our set. And all my friends from school were there, and all the girls were watching me, and And I looked up, and here comes my dad, man. Oh, jeez. And to see an adult in the middle of all these people anyway is, uh-oh. And, man, he was coming after me. He came down there, and I just came off the stage. He grabbed me by my hair in front of everybody and dragged me down the aisle and took me home and wallowed on me pretty good and locked me back in my room. You're going to do what I tell you to do. And I was sitting there about 3 o'clock in the morning. I heard a knock on my window. The guys brought me my money. We had won the contest. I got a little over on him. But when I was 16, finally, this little girl I was chasing, she got pregnant. Of course, right off the bat, I'm irresponsible as hell, and I didn't know anything about anything except she was good looking. But she got pregnant, so I'm going to do the right thing. We're going to get married. And this is, in my thinking, oh boy, we can have sex all the time now. That's what this is about. We don't have to just, you know, that's the first thing that hits my head is, oh boy, we can do anything we want, anytime. We got us a little house, a little apartment thing, and my mom bought me a car. Mom was upset, man, you know. Gee, you don't need to be getting married. You don't know anything about anything. And she was right. I didn't. All I knew how to do was play guitar. That's all I'd ever done. But I had it in my mind, I'm going to be a big star. We're going to be okay. And that lasted about a year, if even that. We had a son who today I think I've seen him maybe 5 or 6 times. And he's like 33 years old. Something like that. I've tried to make contact with him, and he only lives about 30 miles from me, but he doesn't want to have anything to do with me. I pray about that a lot, and I hope someday, about once every 2 months, I found where he's at, and I'll leave a message on his little machine. And he called me back one time. We actually had a lunch set up, and he stood me up, which I can't hardly blame him. I think I stood him up pretty good, too. It wasn't even a year before I was, when the baby was born, man, it was, oh, man, this is not my deal. This kid screams all the time. You know, what is that about? And I'm still out in the beer joints. I'm still out playing those clubs. And I'm taking my little wedding ring off and sticking it in my pocket, hustling the other girls. At 16 years old, I'm already cheating. You know, I hadn't even been in there. Hadn't even got to my other two wives yet. But it was a nightmare. I didn't know anything about that. I remember coming home one night from on the road. We'd go out of town. And my wife was sitting in this little apartment with the little baby screaming. And all we had was two weenies in the icebox. That's the only food they had. I wasn't sending any money home. I wasn't coming home. I didn't know. I was so into me. I was so being a star. I knew her mother was going to take care of her. In my thinking, well, her mother really wasn't doing anything for her either. But I remember that real vivid, coming home. There was two weenies in the icebox for a baby and a grown woman. So I did leave him a little money, and I really left then. I went off to a place, I don't know if you ever heard of it, a place called The Cellar. I ran into this club. It was called The Cellar. And, my God, this place is, it was open from 6 till 6. It was right when rock and roll came in big time. It was really all drugs and everything was hitting big time. Jimi Hendrix and all this stuff, man, and boy, I was into volume now. This club is called The Cellar, and it had, it's the first place I ever saw that had dancing girls in their panties and bras. The waitresses all wore underwear. And I said, man, this is really great. It was all black and had day-glow stuff everywhere, and the thing said, you must be weird or you wouldn't be here on the wall, and evil spelled backwards is live, and, oh, man, I'm home. You played an hour and you're off an hour. You played an hour and you're on off from 6 to 6. You don't have any time. You go home and sleep, and you get back up and you go back to the club. And, man, it's Freak City. I had hair down to my waist by then almost, and I was also one of the first guys to get kicked out of high school for having long hair. I thought that was real cool because I was so special. I want to be different, you know. But that's my first introduction to drugs was in The Cellar. And, man, and this was like 17 years old when I first, I did a year touring around as the Sir Douglas Quintet, oddly enough. I don't know if anybody's up on their rock and roll trivia, but Doug Soms was the leader of that band, and he was in jail for drugs. And his manager hired me and my band to be Sir Douglas Quintet. We were lying, you know, we bogus. It's bogus tours. I mean, and we would we wore wigs and everything because these guys had real long hair, so some of us had wigs on. And we would go play these concerts and tell them we were Sir Douglas Quintet. And we'd do She's About a Mover and Rain, Rain, Rain. And there would be people come with pictures of them and the Sir Douglas Quintet from when they were there last year. And we would convince them that those guys were lying. We're the real Sir Douglas Quintet. I mean, I'd manipulate and twist and whatever it took to make me a star. And anyway, yeah, I got into The Cellar, and boy, that was nuts. That was totally nuts. Started smoking a little pot right off the bat, and they also had a thing called Specials, which was Everclear and grapefruit juice. And if you want to get drunk, drink some Everclear. It'll instantly do it. But it also instantly made me really good looking and a bigger star than I already was. Which is not feasible, actually, but I became the king of The Cellar. It was, I've always written original music, too. That was another God-given gift that I abused for so long. I didn't want to do other people's music. I wanted to write my own. And I did. And I'd be in there, and those girls, they had a runway right in front of the bandstand, and these girls would be dancing like that far from my face, about a foot max. And it was not a pretty picture. These girls were not pictures of health, needless to say. But and I didn't like them dancing to my music of certain songs, and man, I'd stick my foot in their butt and push them out in the crowd. They had these cushions out in front of the thing. So I fought. Because I wanted to be different. You don't dance to my music unless I tell you, Jen. What is that about? Anyway, it worked. They stopped dancing to my music. I think one reason because of bruised butts, but that wasn't all of it. I was good at what I did. I don't think you can get away with a lot of the crap we do if we weren't good at it, whatever it is. But I had to be real good at that. Anyway, I became the king of The Cellar. I needed a girlfriend. I didn't have anything to do with my wife anymore. I had already taken off, and I had no idea whether. I'm sure they went back with their mother. I didn't care. I was just on my star trip. So I met this little girl in a shooting gallery one night. And a shooting gallery, if you don't know what that is, that's where people use needles. Somebody's house or someplace. They'll be in there spiking, shooting up stuff. I never got into needles. That's the only thing I didn't get into. For some reason, needles and me, I don't like that. I got into everything else, though, let me tell you. And I saw this little girl there, and she had run away from home. And she was an angel, this thing, a little blonde-headed, blue-eyed. She really, really looked out of place. She didn't belong there. And I asked about her, and I took her home with me. And I was living with some guy that was my manager. It's another manager. He's just an alcoholic dude that rode along, got me gigs, and because they got free drinks when they did that stuff, too. Anyway, I took her home with me. I mean, it's just like, okay, come on. Bam, I'm going to save this girl because she's shooting up. Well, hell, I'm drinking daily and taking acid. And so I think that was right when I really started hitting. I started streaking down because we were doing LSD and psilocybin and stuff like that. And everybody came to my house to trip. This is, let's go to Nitzinger's house and trip, you know, because I'm a star. I'm the best band in the thing. I'm the guy. And I remember one night, it's my first introduction to the psych ward at Peter Smith. I took some psilocybin. And everybody took it, and everybody's fine. We're cruising along, and it wasn't about 20 minutes. I said, man, something's wrong. I said, uh-oh, this don't feel right. Something is wrong. And I'm looking at everybody, and their faces are green and melting and falling off of their skulls, and I'm going, oh, this is not good. This is not, something is not right. I reached over and kissed my girlfriend, and her lips stretched from here to that wall over there. And I went, holy shit, something is really bad. I was really freaked. I said, take me to the hospital. You got to get me to the hospital. And boy, believe me, nobody wants to give you a ride to the hospital when they're doing the same thing you are. You know, man. I said, I got them to do it. I told them, just drop me off out front. You know, you don't have to come in or anything. And they said, good, because we wouldn't. And they dropped me off over there in Hearst at some hospital, some emergency room. And man, I am freaking. I had this little girl by the hand, and I wouldn't let go of her hand. I'm not sure she wanted to go with me, but she was going, because that's the only thing I could hang on to was her. She was a good girl about it. She wanted to go too and take care of me, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, I got in there, and I told her to let me do the talking. Yeah, I walked up with this, and I went, blah, 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 blah. They had no, I couldn't talk. I had no idea. A lot of drugs. Okay. So they started hitting me with Thorazine, and I remember hearing this nurse say, man, that would have put a horse down. They hit me like five times, and all I could do was sit there and rocking, and I'm rocking, and I'm rocking, and I got my hands between my knees and gritting my teeth and ding, ding, ding. And they hit me that last time, and I lost my mind. I really did. I'll never forget it. I went, bing! It just shot off into space. And I just went limp. I was real relaxed. Nothing was nothing. It was gone. They put me in an ambulance, and they took me up to the Peter Smith Psych Ward. I was in there for 3 days. They rolled me around in a wheelchair. I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. Finally, after about 3 days, I told them my name and my address and my phone number. And they put me in a little room that wasn't locked. Because I don't know if you know Peter Smith, but it's the real deal. The cuckoo's nest type thing. Anyway, they let me out. Or they didn't let me out. They let me out of the locked part of the hospital, and I walked out. I'll never forget coming out of that door and that sunshine hitting me. It was so hot. But for a year, an entire year, I could not smoke a cigarette. I could not drink a beer. I could not smoke a joint. I could not look you in the eye. I could not talk to anybody. I couldn't do anything but walk. I walked. I was one of those mumbling, crazy people you see walking down the streets. I would sing my songs in my head. It's the only thing I could do to hang on to whatever reality there was. And I must have walked 10,000 miles. You'd see me, there's a guy we call Walking George. We see him over in Fort Worth all the time, man. Every time I see him, I said, man, I was Walking John. Because you could see me just all over town. I'd have my head down and I'd just be trucking. Don't know where I'm going, but I'm getting there quick, whatever it is. For an entire year, I was like that. I couldn't play. I couldn't play any music. I couldn't, like I said, I could not look you in the eye. I could not talk to anybody. All I could do was walk. I was crashing at some guy's house, and they were just freaks themselves, and I kind of fit in. They just leave me alone and let me stay in the back room. Anyway, after about a year, the Beatles' White Album came out, and I went to a little party, and they said, oh, come on, you can drink a beer. You know, you've been out there long enough. So I, well, maybe I can. So I started, I got a beer down. And that was incredible. That was really progress for me to be able to drink a beer after all that walking. Then I found out I could smoke a joint. I smoked a joint. Oh, man, I'm feeling better. I mean, from cuckoo's nest to feeling better after a six-pack of beer and a couple of joints. I think I'm going to be okay, you know? Wow. Is that amazing? So, you know what? In 2 weeks, what did I do? I ate some more acid. Is that insane or what? After everything I've been through, in a couple of weeks, I thought I was okay enough. I can drink beer now. I can smoke dope now. Now I take some more LSD. it was a mild little deal. I didn't blow it again, but that was the last time I did that. I went straight ahead into hardcore alcohol. I found that was my drug of choice at the time. The rest, I did a lot of other things too, but they were really just side stuff. Until later on. I have a long story. Oh, I'm up to 17 or 18 now? Holy shit. I'll try to square it up. Point being, for 37 years, I'm 51 years old. For 37 years, I drank and drugged. I missed a lot of my life. There's some big blackout periods in. So anyway, around 24, 25, there's a band called Blood Rock from Fort Worth, a big-time band. And they came to me and asked me to write their songs, and I wrote their songs. And that's when the first time I got rich. I call it rich. It was rich for me. It was pretty damn good. I got on Capitol Records. All of a sudden, I was making it. I was that star I was going to be. Now I'm talking, I got some money now. Before it was just, you know, a few bucks here and a few bucks there. But now I got a whole bunch of money all at once, out of nowhere. Overnight I got like $50,000 for my first royalty check. And the alcoholic that I am, I went out in one day and I bought a house, a car, a dog, a motorcycle, drapes, carpets, television, dinging, everything in one day. What a shopping spree. I went and got it all in cash down at the bank and went home like they do in the movies and threw it up in the air and just were going nuts. I was just spinning the left to right thinking this is never going to end. This is never going to end. I'm going to be a rock star now. And I did. I got through writing for Blood Rock, I got my own record deal. I signed with Capitol Records too. I had three albums with them, and back then it was a lot of money. Back then a record thing was, they gave you money up front. Today it's all sign this and punch that in, punch that. Back then they gave you money, and man, I went nuts. I went out on tour with Leon Russell on the Carney tour. in 72. Again, now I'm in the big time. I'm flying to my gigs. I'm not riding in that damn little car, rent car. I'm taking limousines and stuff. Man, I am peaking. I'm drinking the good whiskey now. I'm drinking Crown Royal, and we got Wild Turkey and stuff, and always beer chasers. And I'm playing before 30,000 people every night. I'm a big star. I really am. You know, I don't remember a lot of that. I remember getting booed off the stage in San Francisco once. I was so drunk, I couldn't say the words, but I could play still pretty good. So I played real loud and mumbled a lot. But I remember in the morning the review said, John Nitzinger is a foolish figure. Oh, man. Well, that really hit me. I remember that hit me. So that gave me a real good excuse to disappear into Frisco for a few days. And which I did, and I don't know how they found me, but they did. I was holed up in some girl's place up there doing drugs and drinking and feeling sorry for myself because they didn't know what a star I was. I did that bit, wore that out, toured a lot, toured with B.B. King for a while, which is an odd combination because I'm real loud and radical. But I had a good blues feel in my music, so I guess that's why we were in there. I moved on to 20th Century Records then. I signed a deal with them in L.A. in 76. And now I'm really making some money. I'm living at the Beverly Hills Hotel. man, Jesus. Today I drive a 72 Ford. It gets me there, but it ain't no limousine, you know, but I love that Ford. I love that old car. Today, I'm skipping around again, but today I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I got a music career in me anymore. I just take it one day at a time. I'm really not sure what's going to happen, but I know God didn't save me from the ocean to drown in the bathtub. So I'm going to keep on taking it one day at a time. I went through 76, and then I think one of the last straws that really stuck me was I joined Alice Cooper Band in 81. And if you know who Alice Cooper is, that says it all. We were really into drugs. We got into the hardcore freebasing and cocaine. I did 3 years on the road with him. In Spain, Barcelona, Glasgow, Scotland, Paris, France, Munich, Germany, and I never saw these places. I was there, but I didn't come out of my room. I stayed, we'd go play. When you're on tour like that, you're on a bus every day. You know you had a long drive when we got on the tour bus and there would be bottles of NyQuil in everybody's bunks. You drink a whole bottle of NyQuil and wake up 2,000 miles later, or two bottles, in my case. I missed it. I never came out of my room, all these beautiful places in the world, but I just didn't come out of my room. We didn't do that. When you're doing what we do, you need some privacy. You don't really do that out in public. You can't do that out in public. But I came home from that tour. And I had a real problem. I knew I had a real problem. Now, what am I going to do about it? I went to like two treatment centers. I checked myself in. I got a problem. I'm going to stop drinking, by God. I checked into Hughley. I stayed like 3 days and said, oh, these people don't understand. They don't know that I'm a star and you need to treat me different. I'm not like you guys. I just got a little problem here. I did that. I went in and out of two or three treatments. I check myself in every time. Because I tried for 7 years to get sober. Just saying I'm going to do it and going in. God works in mysterious ways. After all those years, too, of driving driving drunk, and I never killed anybody. I never got a DWI. That's amazing. I've wrecked cars. I must have wrecked a dozen cars and God knows what. But I finally got a DWI. And I finally had to go get that piece of paper signed. So I got to go to 90 meetings. I got to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I started going to the New Hope, New Life over in Fort Worth, which I thought was a appropriate place for a star because it was all black. Now, they dig blues. These people understand a musician, you know. my word thinking. But whatever it worked. I started hanging around, and I started listening to what they were saying. And at first, I was drinking on the way to the meeting. And on the way home, I'd sit in the back of the meeting with my hat on and shades, and I'm real cool, and they were talking Japanese, I think. I had no idea what they were talking about, you know, but I'm here. I got my paper signed, so I'm going to get sober. I don't know what that, but I started hearing what they were saying, and that's the key is to keep coming back. I had to keep coming back, and oddly enough, I was forced to come back. I relapsed because I wasn't working it big time. And I kind of skipped this too, how God works. Let me back up a little bit. Just before I did this thing with New Hope, New Life, I was laying in the floor, rolled up in a ball, dying in some girl's house. Some girl I was living with, but it's just some girl. Yeah, we had no, I don't even know her middle name. But that was the first time I really asked God to help me. It wasn't a foxhole prayer. It wasn't a get me down this one time, I'll never do it again. I said, God, please help me. I can't do this by myself. I have tried. You're all I got left. And I'm not quite sure how it happened, and I'm penniless by now. I have lost everything. I don't have any money. I'm homeless. I don't have a car. I'm riding around. I'm going around crashing at people's houses on my star name. I could go into a club and find somebody, and they go, oh, you're John Nitzinger, aren't you? And I say, yeah, can I move in with you? Boom. And they go, yeah, we'd love to have you, you know? Well, I went through about 22 people, I think, like that for a while, because it didn't take them long to, hey, this star sucks, you know, this is not, hey, this is really not what I had in mind. Anyway, I said that prayer, and I was literally dying. I was rolled up and had pain in my stomach and everywhere, not to mention, and that's the two freakiest thing in my life that I remember, besides the freak out earlier where I walked, was when I realized I couldn't stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. And then I really got freaked when it wasn't working anymore. I said, holy mackerel, no matter how much I drank or what I stuck in my body, it's not working. My mind is still going 1,000 miles an hour and I'm scared. I am afraid. And don't even know what I'm afraid of. But bad anxiety attacks. And I went to the psychiatrist for a while and tried to do that and get some more pills, you know. I just wound up addicted to Vicodin and Valium too on top of that, because I'm chasing it with alcohol and I'm not telling them how much I'm drinking. You drink down? Yeah, well, a little bit, you know. Shit. Again, that on the Alice Cooper tour, one of the funny things, when I signed up for the tour, they said, what do you want to drink for the next 3 years? Man, you tell an alcoholic that, and boy, sign me up. Because in our dressing room, they have a thing called a writer, and they have to give you whatever you want. If it's M&Ms or whatever you want, they got to have it in your dressing room. I told them I wanted a fifth of vodka, a fifth of whiskey, and a case of Budweiser. This is every day. I mean, not that I could drink all that, but I wanted it, you know. I started throwing clothes out of my suitcase to make room for all these bottles I couldn't drink. It's nuts. Anyway, I got to that real prayer, and out of nowhere come a friend of mine who got in the program after I did. He was an alcoholic, too. He said he read in the paper somewhere, a magazine somewhere, about the Musicians Union would sponsor people that have been in the business. It's called Music Cares. If you've been in, I had like 5 albums from major labels. So he called them up. In 2 days, I was in the Betty Ford Center. I mean, I'm homeless. I have no money. I have no nothing. You know, but if it had been Oklahoma or, I don't know if it had worked. But the star that I am, I can go to the Betty Ford Center. Yeah, we can do that. Because I belong there with those special people. That's my thinking. You know, I accepted it right away. I'll go to Betty Ford Center. And me and Betty, we're like this. I learned a lot there, let me tell you. It doesn't matter who you are. This is a non-discriminatory disease. There was a lot of interesting people there, but we all had the same disease. We all had the same problems. We all had the same bullshit. I started getting it. When I came home, I got into that group. And I'm still homeless. It's funny, come out of the Betty Ford Center, and I don't have enough money to get a cab home. Whoever's home I was staying at the time, just a girl. Anyway, I started going to those meetings. And, you know, and one of the strongest things, too, that it's that ego stuff, that ego I've been fighting all my life, and it still surfaces today. Don't think it doesn't. I'm trying to be different today by doing things like this, working the 12 steps. I do a lot of service work. I go to All Saints Hospital 2 days a week and take meetings up to the detox unit and the psych ward. And every time I say, I was there. I was in that chair you're in when I'm talking to these people. I take a meeting every Sunday to Wackenhut Prison. As for the grace of God, I'm not in that prison. I should be sitting where those guys are. Because there's an incredible amount of crap that I can't got time to tell you about. Some awesome stuff that God did for me, what I couldn't do for myself. Point being, and one of the things too is New Hope, New Life was a little small group, like I said, and it wasn't a real strong group. A month into the deal, they gave me a key to the front door and said, you can chair the new meetings. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm still drinking, actually. I'm still sipping stuff. But again, my ego said, hey, you're special. You got a key to the door. And nobody would come to new meetings. There was nobody there but me. I mean, it's such a small group. But I'd go down there, and I'd open that door, and I'd be there. And every now and then, one guy would show up, maybe two. But most of the time, it was just me. And I would sit there in that room by myself and look at the walls and read these things, look at those steps, take my book and read. Finally, I heard what they said about maybe you ought to get a sponsor, you know. Well, okay. So I finally got a sponsor. And that's when things really started kicking for me. I would suggest getting a sponsor if you don't have one. It took me a while. But once I started working the steps and things started changing for me, immediate physical relief of not throwing up every day, and the anxiety started going away. And you know, I thought I was just crazy. I thought I really was just one of those we read about and how it works. I bet a lot of us thought of that when we came. Oh, that's me. The anxiety when I got into it, when the craving was relieved, taken away from me. I remember when it happened. I remember the day it happened. And I sat in there. I was in a meeting by myself. I was in a meeting by myself at New Hope, New Life. And I had no desire to drink. I sat there and cried for about an hour and a half by myself in that meeting and just prayed and cried. And I kicked into gear. Suddenly, I don't know where it came from. All of a sudden, this stuff made sense. I admitted I was powerless. I finally did. I've always had a belief in God, but I never let Him work for me until I said that prayer that day. Today, I try to let God guide me, and I was on my knees three times this morning before I got up here to speak. Once in there. I'm not really good at speaking, but it's funny, I've been in front of a microphone and crowds all my life, but this is not the same. This is different. I'd like to think it's some humility, because I know I'm not here for me. I'm just here to try to share what God's done for me in this program. I'm incredibly grateful to be sober today. I don't know what future's going to hold for me. Like I said, I don't know if I have a music career anymore. But that's okay. I've been out doing some landscaping with this guy. I got blisters on my fingers. But that's okay. It's such a new world to me. I'm really a child. I'm really a child. And I like to think I'm a child of God, and we all are. And I guess I'll stop babbling now. I really want to thank you for having me down here. And this program works if you work it. And God bless you all. Thank you.